talking with screenwriter and director Tim Hunter, and we're going to discuss the making of Over the Edge and the making of River's Edge. Wanted to talk about Over the Edge first. Can you talk about your career before Over the Edge and how you got involved in the film industry?
Well, my father was a screen and TV writer, so I was kind of a movie brat. I always knew I wanted to do it from an earlier age. I made a bunch of kind of woeful student films, and I was included in the very first class at the AFI way back in 1970. But I wasn't crazy about the AFI, although I did make a short film under their auspices, which is sort of the minimum that they had promised the various fellows, they called them at the time. So I fled the AFI after a year and got a teaching job at UC Santa Cruz, teaching film, not much in the area of production. I was teaching film criticism and history, doing surveys on genre. I did a big film noir class. I did a Hitchcock class, stuff like that. And I was very young when I started teaching. I was only 23, and so I was fairly close to my students. And one of them, a young writer named Charlie Haas, and I became close friends, and we saw a headline in the San Francisco Examiner, I think it was, about a crime spree in a San Francisco suburb called Foster City. The headline was, I believe it was Mouse Packs, Kids on a Crime Spree. And we thought we could turn it into a screenplay. So we went up and spoke with the kids in Foster City and assessed the situation, and it took quite a while to write. We didn't finish Over the Edge. The script was called Mouse Packs when we were writing it, until I had stopped teaching and Charlie had graduated and we were both down in Los Angeles. He was kind of a young star. He was working for Warner Brothers Records, writing stuff for them, and I was doing publicity at a drama show called Visions, based out of the LA Public Television station. And we finished the script in Los Angeles in 74, 75. So that was pretty much it. I'd had a kind of a previous incarnation as a student filmmaker, but needed the time to grow up and work on my writing and stuff. So that was basically the evolution of it. Mm-hmm. When Over the Edge was made and directed by my friend Jonathan Kaplan, who had started directing before I did and had a fair amount of success, Charlie and I had read the earlier novels of S.E. Hinton, because she was the only writer that any of the actual kids that we interviewed in Foster City for Over the Edge had read. She was the only writer that they really admired. Mm-hmm. So I started looking for something that we could possibly do. And I wrote her publisher, and text hadn't come out yet, but they sent me a copy of the book in galleys. And for me, it was my favorite of them for a film adaptation. Of course, Coppola adapted The Outsiders, and Emilio Estevez then later adapted That Was Then, This Is Now. Mm-hmm. But Tex was the one for me, and once Over the Edge came out, looked fairly certain that Matt Dillon, who Jonathan discovered for that film, would become some kind of a movie star. We were able to parlay that package of Charlie and I, of the book, Charlie and I writing, Matt starring, and me as a first-time director into the production at Disney. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of my history.
Was it hard to get Over the Edge made? And why did you guys film it in Colorado instead of another place like California or New York or something?
Well, it wasn't practical to film it in California, I think, just because it was a low budget picture and because of the I can't tell you what the labor laws were. I mean, I don't think they had rebates in those days, but I think it was just too expensive to shoot in California, so they were looking for a place that they could do it cheaper. And I don't know if they got any kind of a 70s version of a rebate the way they do today, but they settled on Aurora, outside of California, which was much less built up then than it is now, and had the kind of suburban feeling, minus the man-made waterways that lined Foster City, but had the same feeling that Foster City had.
And were you on set for the entire Over the Edge production?
Charlie and I were on set for the entire production, and we did an enormous amount of the local casting. Jonathan went to New York to look for his leads, several of whom came from Liz Suedos's off-Broadway production Runaways. And then, of course, he famously discovered Matt, a casting scout of his famously discovered Matt at hanging out outside his high school in Mamaroneck. And in the meantime, Charlie and I went to the Denver area and started looking at all the special schools and the schools for kids who'd had some trouble. And we basically recruited the rest of the ensemble that played alongside those five leads that Jonathan found.
And what was it like working with all those young actors day in, day out?
Well, it was wonderful. Charlie and I were acted as sort of chaperones for this larger group of stoners and deadheads and misfits, all of whom had a ton of heart and were great. And we had our issues of Jonathan and Kenny Friedman had done a polish on the script, not all of which we agreed with, but it really wasn't very extensive when I look back on it. And the producer, George Lido, who I had known, I mean, that's really how we got it made. I knew George Lido because he had been an agent and a manager for a bunch of the blacklisted writers. And he had helped Ring Lardner set up MASH. He had represented my father for a while. He was friends with Waldo Salt and a bunch of the blacklisted writers. So I knew George and used to hang out there as a kind of a young apprentice type. So he was the first person to see the script when Charlie and I finished it. And he bought it right away, basically. And then he had trouble making it. Orion finally made it. Mike Medavoy finally agreed to make it. But Orion passed on the thing about four times before they finally said yes to it. And, but all's well that ends well. And, it wound up being, it was really the first picture they ever produced, although it never got much of a theatrical release originally. And the film A Little Romance with Diane Lane became their first official production.
I was going to ask you about the release, and it kind of got shelved because of problems with other films released at the same time, right?
Yeah, there had been some violence in theaters surrounding a couple of films that had gang stories. Nothing quite so young as our story, but there were problems at screenings of Boulevard Nights, possibly The Wanderers. I'm not sure if I'm right on that one, but certainly Boulevard Nights was an issue because there had been some violence at theaters, and so it was effectively shelved. We tried to arrange for a couple of small screenings. We had a kind of independent screening of it one night only at the Fox Venice. But it never really got a release until the film was revived by what was then the public theater's cinema operation, a kind of short-lived adjunct to the Public Theater in New York, and they revived it and had quite a successful run with it. And at that point, it got some theatrical distribution after that.
You went on to direct, you already talked about Tex, and then another film about alienated young people, Sylvester. And then you went on to direct River's Edge. Was that a theme that kind of resonated with you, lost young people?
Well, I always felt very passionate about my own teenage years, so I identified with stories about teenagers, the intensity of their emotions and their loyalties and friendships and their ideals. So I've always had an affinity for teenage stories. Sylvester was not much more than a horse picture, basically. And when Midge Sanford and Sarah Pillsbury first showed me the script to River's Edge, I was fairly dubious about doing it. That was before I had read it, because I didn't really want to do another teen picture. But then I read the script, which was just so incredibly good. I called them back instantly and basically told them I had to do it. There was one other director in the running, and I really lobbied hard for it. But one of the things about River's Edge is that Midge and Sarah had been showing the script to studios based on the success that they had had with Desperately Seeking Susan. Mm-hmm. And so they had been showing the River's Edge script to studios as a potential picture in the $5 million range. And nobody would touch it because it was so dark. And as part of my lobbying campaign to do the picture, I said I would make it for $1 million. And that sort of changed the parameters. And all of a sudden, it became possible to submit it to a number of young indie companies that were popping up at that time. And Hemdale bought it. Bought the package, and it was in pre-production in a remarkably short period of time. I think, from when I first read it, and Midge and Sarah and I agreed that I would do it, and I think we were in pre-production maybe 4 months after that, trying to make it as inexpensively as possible. The final budget, I think, was like 1.7.
Can you talk about the casting of the film, why some of those specific people were chosen?
Well, we set up shop in an old film production building on Victory Boulevard in the Valley, a place I had found out about from doing some posts there on a previous picture, and I had an office there. And so we set up in this building, and Midge and Sarah had Carrie Fraser to cast it. It was her first job. She subsequently became head of casting at HBO, though she's now retired. And we just did extensive auditions, and we didn't have money to offer it to any of the John Hughes Brat Pack crowd. We just saw dozens and dozens and dozens of young actors. And so it was really just cast through auditions. The most difficult parts to cast, besides the Dennis Hopper part, which was subject to a lot of back and forth looking for somebody to do it. I had initially hoped that John Lithgow would play it, but it was too dark for John. He wanted no part of it. It was hard to cast Keanu's part and Ione's part, and we saw lots and lots and lots of people. But Carrie found out about Keanu from his agent. He was a hot young kid from Canada who had just come down to Hollywood and hadn't done anything yet. And we pretty much cast him as soon as we saw him. And it was much harder to cast Clarissa. And we saw a lot of people for it. I saw a photograph, a small fashion spread photograph in the LA Weekly that Ione had done. Mm-hmm. And just thought that she had a good look and suggested that we bring her in. And And we did, and we tested her, and we tested her opposite Keanu, and she had that great quality that she has. And finally, we cast her at the last minute. It's funny. I mean, we saw so many people there. The part of Keanu's brother, I don't know if you know this, we originally cast Corey Haim.
Yeah, I talked to Midge Sanford a couple weeks ago, and she told me about that.
Yeah, and we actually, and after we had cast him, we saw Josh Miller, and we kind of said, boy, he's got an interesting quality, you know, but nothing much that we could do about it. And then we started shooting the picture with Corey, but Corey got really sick after the first day of production, came down with pneumonia or something, and we had to let him go. And there was Josh, so we drafted him, Josh Miller, we drafted him right away, and that was a yet another case where God watches out for independent filmmakers. In the case of Hopper, we knew he wanted to do it. We had some reluctance that it might be kind of typecasting for Dennis, but ultimately, we wanted him very badly, and we needed for Hemdale to come up with a little extra money for him. And in order to do it, I threatened to cast Timothy Carey, actor in the Stanley Kubrick's The Killing and Cassavetes' Killing of a Chinese Bookie, who was a kind of brilliant but well-known wild man who would never stick to a script and would ad lib and be quite disruptive. And I think the thought of having Timothy Carey in the picture finally convinced Hemdale to come up with some small amount of money to pay Dennis to do it.
What if somebody sees it then?
They're still after me. You know that. They've been after me for 20 years. I mean, you kill a person, they don't let you forget. They stick after you like ghosts. I mean, they don't believe you when you say you're sorry. They want you to pay somehow.
And that was that.
And Midge Sanford told me that Harry Dean Stanton was somebody you guys originally wanted for that role, too.
Yeah, I mean, Harry Dean Stanton was a logical choice for that part, but he didn't like the part. He never, he didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember about the actual production? Do you remember any particular unusual challenges or circumstances while you guys were filming River's Edge?
Well, the big challenge was nature. Otherwise, it was a very smooth production, which somehow, for the small amount of money that we had, I believe we managed to eke out to close to 30 days, which would be unheard of now. Now you'd be lucky to shoot the picture in 18 days. But Neil Jimenez, who wrote it, had gone to school and grew up in Sacramento. And the script was a fictionalized version of what he'd read about the Jacques Broussard murder in Milpitas, California, filtered through his own experiences with his deadhead buddies in high school in Sacramento. And so that was the river that he had in mind. And we went up there and scouted it and had decided to that we would go up there to shoot the river scenes on the sort of northwest branch of the American River. Then there was a huge storm and flood when we started shooting, and Highway 5 was closed, and a lot of that river, the river rose and was flooded and was underwater. And so it was really, really a dicey proposition as to whether or not we could go up there to shoot. And the completion bond company that was bonding the picture, of course, just looking at the budget, didn't want us to go anywhere near Sacramento. And they wanted us to shoot it in Malibu Creek, which basically is a little trickle, you know, maybe 6 feet across. it was a really tough situation because the producers were nervous, and I was trying to be resolute. There was no place in Los Angeles really that would give it to us at all. And then at the very last minute, before we were scheduled to go up there, the road opened and the waters ebbed, and I said, "We're going," and rallied everybody, and we made it up there. And it was wonderful, of course, because coming on the heels of the storm and the flood, the water had that wild, raging quality that it hadn't had before. And the riverbanks where we shot the scenes between Hopper and Dan Roebuck, you know, all kinds of driftwood had washed up. That log that they sat on had washed up, and the whole thing just had a marvelous quality that it hadn't had before in its much tamer incarnation before the flood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the look of the film is very unique. As a kid, I always thought it was set in Washington or Oregon. What was the thought process behind the kind of visual aspect of River's Edge?
I don't know that there was that much pre-visualization of a look for the film. We certainly tried to take advantage of what we found. I settled on Tujunga for the major locations because Tujunga, which is a community up in the foothills above Burbank, was an older community that was originally settled in the first part of the century as an area where people with tuberculosis could come and come to sanatoriums there for the clean air. Of course, by the time we shot River's Edge, it had just become a smog pocket. But it was full of those river rock houses, and it had parks and stuff that gave it a kind of land that time forgot feeling that I really wanted. What I didn't want to do is go back to the bedroom suburbs of new houses of Over the Edge, a look that Spielberg had mined to good effect in a number of pictures between Over the Edge and River's Edge. So I wanted it to have a kind of a timeless feel. The rock house, overgrown park, rundown feel of Tujunga meshed, I think, with the wildness of the river by the time that was there when we got to Sacramento and created a look for it, largely from the locations and then, of course, from the excellent photography of Fred Elms. And Fred and I, knowing that we wouldn't have much budget, would get together with the cast on weekends and rehearse and try to work the shots out ahead of time. And we really tried to plan it so that when we actually got to shooting it, there wouldn't be any extra shots that we hadn't listed beforehand. And it was a bit of a running joke. Whenever I came up with a new shot, he would always kind of give me a little rueful smile like I had broken our covenant. So, you know, we hadn't planned out the look, I think, is as much due to the locations as anything, but we did, we had pre-storyboarded it in large measure before we shot it. Mm-hmm.
You were working with kids again on River's Edge, just like you had earlier in your career. How did this time compare to Over the Edge and Tex? Were there differences, or had you learned from those earlier experiences?
You know, the thing that I learned on Tex, which was my first picture, was a love for actors, young or old. I think I learned on Tex in a way that I hadn't, you know, of course, just doing student films. It's a very difficult, very personal process. Actor has to keep it fresh, take after take, find the truth of it, the heart of it in their own hearts, and make it all come from a place of very real emotion inside themselves. So I developed a real respect for the process of acting on text. And I suppose just because of my own passionate feelings about my own teenage years, I've always had an affinity for younger actors and understood the kind of committed place that that the best of them are coming from. So I can't say that I had a different experience on River's Edge than I had had on the others, although I was a more experienced director by then. But it was a marvelous cast, and those kids were just great, and we all really they loved each other. And Hopper was wonderful. He had cleaned up his act and was very proud of it, and he wasn't drinking and he wasn't doing drugs, and he made himself available to all of those kids who idolized him, of course, and he rehearsed with them extensively. He rehearsed, I think he over-rehearsed in a few places, but he just made himself available to those kids. It was a really good experience. Crispin, of course, you know, there was great method to his madness. He had figured out before he even first auditioned for it what his interpretation of the part was and how he wanted to play it, right down to the wardrobe and the wig. And so with Crispin, it was really just a question of making a decision up front that what he would bring would benefit the picture, which it certainly did. And then with Crispin, there were times where I tried to pull him back a little bit, or you know, modulate a little bit the flamboyance or the eccentricity of what he was doing. But those times were few and far between. I mean, basically, we knew what he was going to do because he had shown us ahead of time. And so it was a question of working with it rather than creating it on the spot.
It's people like you that are sending this country down the tubes. No sense of pride, no sense of loyalty, no sense of nothing, man. Why do you think there's so many fucking welfare cases in this country? Why do you think it is that Rush is gearing up to kick our asses, man?
Drink your beer, Lane.
No, I won't drink my fucking beer. I'm talking here. These things are important to me. And believe it or not, you're important to me.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine anybody else in that role besides him.
Yeah, I mean, on the page, it could have gone to any one of a number of the, you know, brasher, more charismatic Brat Packers. And on the page, it's the Feck, the Dennis Hopper character, who's by far the most extreme character in the script. But in casting Crispin with that strong and wild interpretation, it changed the whole dynamic of the picture, I always felt, so that Hopper's character, in a way, became more the kind of quiet moral center of the film in a perverse kind of way. And Crispin's character takes on much more than just the kind of misguided, you know, leader of the high school pack that one might have assumed it would be just from reading it on the page.
The kids in River's Edge didn't dress like other kids from movies in the 1980s. That gave River's Edge another level of authenticity, I thought. Was that a conscious decision going in as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, having worked with so many real kids and Over the Edge and dealing with real life, that was always something that we strived for. Strove for? What do you say there?
But I'm not sure.
Well, you can look it up. And Claudia Brown, our young costume designer, was very tuned into that. So I think a lot of the credit goes to her. The big oversized sweater that Ione wears, the jacket with the peace emblem painted on the back that Keanu wears. That all came from Claudia, and Crispin pretty much had his outfit picked out, as I said, before he even auditioned for the film, let alone started shooting the film. So, but yeah, I mean, if I had grown up in the Midwest in the kind of middle class John Hughes, you know, world, I guess I wouldn't have, you know, had this kind of affinity. But my heart was always with the stoners and the deadheads and the kids that didn't really quite know how to cope with the culture. And so it all came fairly naturally, I think, to us working on this film.
You've said a couple times now about how your teenage years influenced you throughout your career. What specifically?
I think that one develops very passionate friendships and loyalties and ideals as a teenager. One tends to be a bit more absolutist about one's values, and you know you haven't had to deal with that much compromise yet. And I think somewhere along the line, I had a marvelous time in high school at the High School of Music and Art in New York City, and made a lot of very close friends, people who are still my closest friends. And I just remember thinking at the time, you know, what it was like to fall in love for the first time, what it was like to feel so strongly about friendship, that I remember at the time thinking that I wanted to hold on to that. I didn't want to compromise it as I got older, that I wanted these to be my values, that I would, the values that I would stick to. And I hope in some measure I have, but it was a conscious commitment in high school to try to hang on to a certain kind of intensity of emotion and loyalty to my friends and loyalty to principle. Maybe some of this was reinforced by growing up as a red diaper baby blacklist kid, watching my father and all his wonderful writer and actor friends dealing with their careers, staying true to principle by not naming names during the blacklist year. I don't know, but to the extent that I can answer your question, I made a kind of conscious commitment when I was a kid to try to hang on to the intensity of the values that I thought were most important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you still feel that way today, you think?
Yeah, I think I do. And I think even my kids do. My family, we always wear our hearts on our sleeves and put our real feelings out there. And we get kicked around sometimes, but always think that it's better to put that passion and that feeling out there, even if it's not always reciprocated.
So after the film was completed, and when it had its debut at a film festival, and I've heard it was either Toronto or Vancouver, I'm not sure which one is the right one, but were you there, and do you remember what the reaction was like?
I guess it would have had to have played at Toronto before it went to Sundance. I don't remember. We shot it in 86. It was at Sundance in January 87. I think it went to Toronto. I know it went to Mill Valley. It was at Telluride. So I don't know. You'd have to look it up. But I assume that if it went to Telluride in Toronto, that would be 86 rather than later in 87, because it opened in April 87.
Right.
So it would have had to have been there. Yeah, I went to every goddamn festival screening I could. I love going to festivals with films.
What were the reactions like when people saw this for the first time?
Well, the reactions were good, but it didn't really take off until Sundance. The Sundance screening kind of put it over the top, I think, in terms of its reception, and that's when Island Films picked it up from Hemdale. and distributed it. Oddly enough, the screening that I remember most before the film opened was not a festival screening, but was a screening at a big multiplex theater in San Jose near Milpitas, where the actual murder had taken place. And somehow they arranged a screening for the San Jose Milpitas community at this big kind of dome-like multiplex where I believe I had seen The Godfather in the early 70s when I was in Santa Cruz. And that screening was really interesting because a lot of the audience was really up in arms, saying, you know, why are you raking us over the coals again? You know, why are you bringing all this back? We've had enough notoriety with this murder case. But the principal of the local high school and people from the police department came up to us afterwards and said that we'd really gotten it right, and that that's what those kids were like, the ones who Jacques Broussard had taken back and forth over the much longer period than is covered in the movie to see the body of the girl that he strangled.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you quickly about the soundtrack of the film. I think it's one of the better soundtracks of the 1980s for sure. How did that come together?
Well, it was just fortuitous. Again, we didn't have any money. When we were cutting the film, I temp tracked it with you know what that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the temporary music that we put on to suggest where we wanted music and what it would be like. And I temp tracked it with Metallica, primarily stuff from Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets. But of course we couldn't get anywhere near to affording Metallica. And we offered the film to the Eels, a well-known alt-rock band at the time. And the guy from the Eels said that the film was morally reprehensible and they didn't want any part of it. And then our music supervisor, whose name I forget, but it's on the picture, he was very good, and the woman who was his assistant was especially good. They contacted the Enigma Metal Blade label and got them to agree to turn the entire catalog over to us. So I went to see those guys and came back with a shitload of Enigma Metal Blade label LPs, which included Slayer, Fate's Warning, Corrosion of Conformity, and some of the others. And I just pulled all the music from that catalog. I knew I wanted one cut from Burning Spear on it because I'm a Burning Spear fanatic. And so we found that one track from Burning Spear that they let us have. And the Hank Ballard, somehow I found those Hank Ballard R&B oldies and mm-hmm. probably had tracked them on the picture in the first place. And we were able to license those fairly cheaply from, I believe, Warner Brothers music library. So that's how it all came together. But it basically came together because Enigma turned the entire catalog over to us.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on River's Edge now, 30 years later, what do you think the legacy of the film is? And is it something, do you go back and revisit it very often, or has it been a while?
Well, I revisit it often enough because the film is revived periodically, or I'm asked to go to a screening or something. And since the picture is kind of my claim to fame, and I'm still quite proud of it, I'm usually fairly amenable to truck along and and support anybody, any screenings of River's Edge that are out there. The fact that the film is still shown and that people still, you know, come up to me and say that it meant something to them, you know, means a lot to me. So for me personally, I think I just feel my legacy is that I made one film, you know, that that made a difference to some people, and it's not necessarily a great auteur career, but I'm not so unhappy about it either. You know, I went my films after River's Edge, I turned a lot of stuff down, probably stuff that I shouldn't have turned down after River's Edge, and the features that I made were not successful, and I went largely into television, as many directors do. But I've done a lot of work in TV, and the main thing for me is that I just love directing. I love doing it, and so this path, I've enjoyed it more than I would have if I'd had to wait, you know, 4 years between features, struggling all the time to get stuff off the ground. So I think that for me, the legacy of River's Edge is just that I got to make it. I remember when I was making River's Edge, because I had such admiration for Neil's script, I just remember thinking, you know, please God, just one more in my career as good as this one. But it hasn't happened yet. But gee, it was a good script.
No, my darling.